Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spiders. This one's going to be a bit different because the majority of the podcast this time around is going to be my interview with Animals at Home. I've already asked people to go over and check it out, but I know a lot of people haven't had the time to go over or don't want to check it out. And plus, he was nice enough to tell me I could go ahead and run the whole thing on my podcast as well, which I thought was, you know, incredibly nice and accommodating of him. But I said, you know, we'll give it a few weeks. Let it run on his, and then I'll put it on mine afterwards. So this will be like an extra long episode because I'm going to talk a little bit at the beginning, and then there'll be about an hour of the interview or so, and then we'll close this one out with my normal ramblings that I do at the end of the podcast. How's that? So for anybody that has heard the interview already and gone over, thanks so much for giving it a listen. Hopefully it was entertaining. If you're paying attention, I created my own species of tarantula in it. Somebody pointed it out to me. And that was one of the worries about doing something live where every once in a while you slip and say something silly. And when I'm doing my podcast, if I slip and say something silly enough, I can always go back, delete it, and re-record it. In this case, it was live, so there was nothing I could do. So feel free to try to see which species Tom Moran tried to create. And it was pretty embarrassing when the guy gave me the time and I listened to it. I'm like, oh my gosh, how did I not hear that? Or I would have probably asked him to, you know, put a note in there or something. But whatever, I hope people realize that sometimes you're on a roll and you think you sound really good. And then you go back and listen to it and you're like, what in God's name am I talking about? And this was one of those instances. So anyway, funny little one in there for people paying attention. So again, if you want to listen to it, it'll be on the end of this one. If you've already listened to it, thank you. When I get done talking, feel free to skip off and go on to your day-to-day, whatever it may be you're doing. And for those of you who are currently at work, and I've had a lot of people lately tell me I help get them through the workday, which means a lot because I've had a rough school year as far as getting through that. I don't want to make it sound worse than it is, but I get that and appreciate it. And I've worked jobs before where I used to do boat repair back in the day, fiberglass boat repair for many, many years. And it was definitely music and talk radio and things of that nature that would get me through my day sometimes. It would, you know, bring a little cheer. So I do appreciate that. And for those of you listening that are, you know, work in the Postal Service, the UPS, FedEx, any of the many people out there delivering the Christmas packages. You guys have some long days, long hours ahead of you. I don't know how you do it, honestly. So, you know, stay warm. And for those of you that are listening to this, again, it's really cool for me to know that I'm helping people pass the time. So anyway, moving on to our topics for today, before we get on into the interview, first one I want to talk about that I'll be revisiting. I kind of hit this one. I think I've hit this one every year now, but I think it bears repeating. And I think some people need to hear it. With winter shipping, with buying tarantulas in the wintertime. And I know I've covered a whole thing on this, but I just want to touch briefly on it because I've already started receiving emails from people who don't understand how the process works and feel like they're being cheated or jerked around by vendors. And it's one of the tougher ones for me to answer and be polite about because sometimes I get some really nasty emails from people. I got one recently how basically telling me that one of the people I recommended is a ripoff, and because they didn't want to ship directly to his home. And anyway, the issue that seems to pop up the most is the fact that obviously with FedEx, when you order something from FedEx, the nice thing about FedEx or UPS or US Post is that they bring it directly to your door. We're used to ordering things from Amazon. We order from Amazon with Amazon, you get the 2-day shipping, and next thing you know it, you know, 2 days later, well, lately they haven't been that great with it, but 2 days later it's supposed to be on your doorstep. Now, with spiders is a little bit different. They're live animals. So if I order, say I just ordered a box of Transformers, not saying I did, but I did, and they come via UPS, say, I don't know, we'll say noon on a Monday, and it's 30 degrees out. They're going to sit outside in 30-degree weather until I get home or Billy gets home around 3 o'clock or so. So that's 3 hours they're sitting outside in freezing temperatures, which, who cares? It's inanimate objects. It's plastic toys. It's not going to harm them. No harm's going to come to them. Even if it's raining, they're protected. They're inside plastic, whatever. They're fine. Now, animals in place of those. Now you have an issue. And this is where things get kind of icky because A, with a lot of FedEx, you need to be there to sign. And people, if you're not home to sign or they think you're not home, and that's important to consider, then what they do is they take that package, they leave that nice little slip saying, hey, we tried to deliver, please, you know, call us or we'll try again tomorrow. And you can either drive to your local FedEx and go pick up the package, which can be very inconvenient, or you can wait for it to be delivered again, which means it's going to be out on a cold truck again, possibly for many hours. And by that point, your heat pack's probably dead. And let me just share a little story about why I no longer ship to my home. I used to ship to my home and would try to arrange to have somebody home for it because they give you a pretty good window when they're going to be there, like by 11, by 9, whichever. And Billy and I were usually here. Well, one day, I basically took a half day off at work. I had a huge shipment coming in, wanted to make sure I got them. Now, granted, I work where I work. It's literally maybe 5, possibly 10 minutes from the FedEx place they ship from. But I came home, waited for them to get delivered. I'm sitting here waiting. The window goes by. All of a sudden, I get the text message. We tried to deliver. You weren't home. I'm like, what? they went out and tried to deliver and apparently knocked on my garage door. Now, nobody's going to hear anything from the garage door, and unfortunately, there's not a doorbell there. Decided nobody was home, didn't bother to walk around the porch to the front of my house where I was sitting and would have seen and heard them, and left the thing. So I ended up having to drive all the way down back to where I work. I won't say the town. But it was later. It was like this was at 11 o'clock, I think, was when it was supposed to be delivered or when, you know, they tried to deliver it supposedly. We had to go back when the truck got back, which was about 5:30. So talk about inconvenient. I took a half day off work to drive all the way back down to where I work at 5:30 to pick these things up. And in this particular instance, the weather wasn't particularly bad. So there was really kind of a no harm, no foul in that respect. Now, had it been a chilly day, the guy shows up here, knocks on the door, supposedly. Nobody answers the garage because that's where people live in their garage. Turns around, drives off. That thing's on that truck for the rest of the day until 5:30 for hours. And those heat packs, a lot of them will pack them, especially depending on when you order. A lot of people will pack on a Sunday. They mail them on a Monday. So now we're already 24 hours into it. They come to Tuesday. Those heat packs start to wear down. Now you've got a spider that doesn't have heat protection. So what many reputable dealers have started doing, and I'm glad, I know it's a little inconvenient, but we're talking about living animals here, is that when the temperatures aren't right, when they're above a certain point or below a certain point, and again, it can depend on where the package is coming from, where it's going to, those temperatures can vary during the course of the year. They will basically say that if it's above a certain temperature or below a certain temperature, you have to pick up your package from a ship center. This is not to inconvenience you. This is not to save anybody money or to save the dealer's money, because that's one of the things I've been getting quite a bit is, yeah, they're trying to basically charge me this much for shipping and they won't even bring it to my home. No, it's incredibly expensive to ship something FedEx. The last time I shipped a spider FedEx, I believe it was, I want to say California. So obviously across country. But it was $110 for overnight. It was over $100. I don't want to exaggerate, but it was definitely over $100 for the overnight shipping. That's a lot of money. And yes, some of the bigger dealers will get discounts, but it's still a big chunk of money. So it's not about getting money from you. They don't like getting emails saying, hey, I just got home from work. My box was on the doorstep and my spiders are all dead. Or, hey, I just got home from work and apparently I missed the delivery window and now they're back at the place and then they get them later on and the spiders are dead. It's for the safety of the animals. So please, I implore people, like if you don't care about the animals enough to worry about their safety in inclement weather or when it's cold, when it's hot, don't get into the pet hobby because this is a hobby that requires, I've said this many times, any hobby, but anything you do that involves animals requires patience. And if you're the type that gets upset when you order something and you can't wait for it to come in and you freak out, then maybe you should find somebody local to buy from. It's going to cut down the amount of species you can get, but at least, you know, you won't get upset and the spiders will be safe. Because what seems to be happening is people have it in their minds. And here's another important thing to consider. When you order your tarantulas and you don't choose or you choose, you know, overnight shipping, that doesn't mean your tarantula is coming the next day. They're taking orders. They can only ship out no matter who you're dealing with, which companies out there. There's a lot of great vendors out there. You have to remember they have to pack all these up, put the heat packs in. They have a limited amount of time to get them down there. There's only so many they can ship at a time. So please pay attention to whatever vendor you're getting from, the confirmation when it's going to ship. Don't expect it to come the next day. So let's get that out of the way, because I think a lot of this comes from the fact that people, and I've had this one quite a bit too, I just ordered from blah, blah. I picked next day shipping. It's now the next day, and they just told me my order wouldn't be coming in until way later on. That's not how it works. You have to remember they've probably got a bunch of other orders. They're going to ship when it's safe, when they have the time to properly do so. So we need patience there. When you get the email saying, hey, we're going to ship to a ship center, look at what the weather is. It's usually going to be because, I mean, as far as I know, the dealers I've spoken to, it's because of the weather. They don't want that package sitting out on a truck in freezing cold weather longer than it has to be. That's for the sake of the animals. I've opened boxes of dead tarantulas before. I shared the story of the Christmas, right after Christmas where I ordered the box. It's horrific. Nobody wants that. And it's terrible for the animals. I mean, it's like animal abuse. If you're doing something that's leading these animals to be frozen to death because you're impatient, that's not how this whole thing works. So please keep that in mind if you're ordering from anybody during this time of year, expect that your package isn't going to be coming the next day. Pay attention to those, whatever they use, confirmation emails, whether it's a, you know, an automated one or a person sending you one. Pay attention to the times. If there's a question, be polite and ask, hey, why is it going out then? Don't just immediately assume that they're trying to hold your tarantulas because there's some bizarre monetary gain they're going to get out of it. It doesn't work that way. If they contact you, B, and tell you that it needs to go to a ship center, that's because they're trying to protect the animal. Usually it ends up, I think with some places, they actually charge you less if it goes to a ship center because it doesn't have to be out on the truck. So you save a little bit on shipping. It can be inconvenient. I get it, because for some people, I'm fortunate in that the ship center, I mean, if I were to go from my home where I'm sitting right now to the ship center, it's about 20 miles away, 25 miles away. So it's an okay drive, about 20 minutes, so 25 minutes on the, you know, straight off the highway almost. However, if I'm at work, it's very close. So it's convenient for me. However, I get with some people, depending on what state you're in, what town you're in, you might not have one nearby. Make a day out of it. You know, you'd probably be taking a day off work in some cases to receive the package anyway. If you're having it shipped to your home, take a half day, drive up, grab yourself lunch, and grab a box of spiders that you know at least are going to be alive because they weren't left in the truck freezing. That's the way I would say to think about it. But let's try to keep the welfare of the animals in mind when we're ordering in the wintertime. Because I think, again, we live in a society now. I was trying to explain this to my kids, and they're like looking at me in awe. How many people out there are old enough to remember when you'd send away for stuff, and it was like 4 to 6 weeks for delivery? Like you'd buy something out of a catalog, it would be 4 to 6 weeks before that thing would come in. A lot of people don't remember what it was like to, like, you ordered something and sometimes it would show up and be like, oh, I forgot I even ordered this. This is amazing. Now we have, like I said, you hop on, it's instant gratification. Everybody's doing 1 or 2 day shipping. Amazon even does 1 day shipping on some stuff now. I think we've gotten to a point where we're used to getting our stuff immediately. We hand over the money and the stuff immediately shows up. And although that's obviously very convenient and it makes our life so much easier, I think when we try to bring that same level of expectation over to shipping animals, it's completely inappropriate and can be dangerous to the animals. We have to get out of that mindset that things are instantaneous. So what I will tell you from experience, and this is from a guy who loves, like right now I'm waiting for a box of something, it's driving me nuts. I love getting my stuff in on time. When I get my shipping notification, I get all excited. I'm one of those people that gets that, what is it, the shopper's high or something. When I get something coming in, I'm so excited about it. So I totally get it. But I've had packages held for months. I had some place I was ordering from that I never ordered from before. Wasn't sure how good their winter packing was. And I ended up ordering in November and had them ship out, I think it was close to March the next year. And they were okay with holding it. I was okay. You know, as much as I want, I'm like, all right, at least they're going to be shipped out in a time where they're going to be safe. So I've done it myself. I'm speaking from experience, and I'm a guy who loves getting my stuff, you know, my stuff in immediately. I'm your Amazon shopper that loves getting that stuff, you know, second or next day. So I get it, but we need to start thinking of the animals. And please, if you're going to get upset because there's going to be a delay because of weather or because you're going to have to drive a little while, then just try to find some place local and save everybody a lot of aggravation, because it's an unreasonable expectation. It's what drives me nuts, and I think what really kind of lit a fire under me to do this one is I've had two instances in the last 2 weeks, because weather is now getting much colder, where I tried to, you know, Tom's Big Spider it and do it really reasonable and tactful, like, hey, here's the issue. And in both, one instance worse than the other, in both cases, the person came back still like, no, I'm sorry, that's completely unreasonable. I ordered this thing. I paid the money for it. It should be on my doorstep one case, the guy wanted it the next day. And I was like, all right, I'm done with you. Said, if I were you, I'd just cancel your order and go buy it for someplace local. And the other case, it was, I don't understand why it can't come to my home. And even after I explained it. So keep this in mind when you're ordering. Keep in mind, and the other thing that I'm going to mention, and I've had some people, I probably should have started with this, but yes, you can order in the wintertime. That's the other thing people have asked me lately, is it okay to order in the wintertime? But do keep in mind as you order, and I have to remember this, you're thinking what your temperatures. Usually when I order, I'm looking, all right, Connecticut, it's going to be 45 degrees. Great. You have to look at where the package is coming from. So if it's coming from someplace where their highs are currently 80 degrees, and this has happened before, where one place it's been like in the 80s that I've ordered from, and then up here it's been freezing, you have to remember that makes packing extra difficult. Because if they put a heat pack in that, and it's 80 degrees, and it gets stuck in that truck in the 80 degree weather, you're going to fry the spiders. Yeah, the heat pack will be great for the colder temps that they're going to be heading towards when they head toward you. but it's not going to be good for there. So you have to kind of keep that type of stuff in mind too, because that does work into the whole equation of how to ship safely. So please keep that in mind. But yes, you can ship in the wintertime. I've received many packages in the wintertime. I will tell you, the people that I've dealt with, I've had two instances over the course of the years. One was a private seller that basically I'd ordered tarantulas from. She was in a place where it was like in the 40s. It almost ended up below zero here at one point. I had asked not to ship. She shipped and she didn't put a heat pack in it. And that was devastating. That was, I believe, 7 or 8 dead spiders right on the spot. The other incident was a vendor that unfortunately was experimenting with a new type of packing material, and the package got lost for a day, and the packing material was not sufficient to keep the heat in. It was an unfortunate incident, but they were very apologetic. Sadly, it was one of those things that happened. It sounded like a good idea. It happened. They recognized the issue. They fixed it, and it never happened again. But normally when I've ordered from people online and had things shipped, the packing is incredible. Like, you'd be amazed. I had a package from Jamie's Tarantulas, I believe, years ago that got stuck in transit. It was the winter time. I'm like, oh my God, these guys are going to be dead. They were perfectly fine when I got them. I think they were, I want to say right around freezing here the whole period, and they were lost for 2 days, and they came in. They were perfectly fine. It was great. I opened them up. They all ate. It was great. No problem. I still have them. So, yes, you can ship in the winter. Be aware that there are going to be delays. Be aware that the package may not be coming right to your doorstep. And if you choose to go against, if you choose to go, I don't care, I will pay the extra money, have it to my doorstep, that's more convenient for me, even though it may put the spider in jeopardy, you'll probably be voiding your LAG, your live animal guarantee. And keep that in mind, that if you receive the package, because I've had one of these emails, and this one was a tough one for me, and I think I broke character a little bit on it, they basically wanted the package to come to their house. They didn't understand why they would have to go to a ship center. It came to their house. The tarantulas were cold, and one of them died. And then they went, well, I want you to replace this. No, you've just voided that, because they're doing this for safety reasons. If you basically poo-poo their safety reasons, the rules they put in place to protect the spiders, then that's on you. And quite frankly, if I was a dealer, and Billy and I have joked about this before, like, we ever decided to do this, like, if I retire and sell tarantulas, God forbid, I would be like, you know what? No, I'm not sending you anything else. I don't care. Take your business elsewhere. Go up, throw up bad reviews on Facebook. I don't care. You're not treating the animal's life with respect, because you're ignoring things that safety protocols that we put in place to make sure these animals are okay. So that's it. I feel badly for this, because I'm sure a lot of people out here, and I'm not, the people that listen to me tend to be, from what I've gathered from, you know, some of our conversations, I've had some people come over to the YouTube channel, because I think they realize that I'm on those comments a lot quicker than I am the Facebook ones. I just don't have time in the day to do everything. So a lot of people have been coming over, which has been great, because I love interacting with you guys, because you tend to be some of the brightest, most educated, informed people out there. It's like, I had some great conversations, because anybody that wants to listen to some dude ramble on about spiders, you know, on a podcast for this long, obviously has an interest in it, which is great. So I'm suspecting the audience out there, it's probably falling on deaf ears. But what you guys can do is, when you see these things pop up, like on forums or on Facebook groups, and people start complaining about this, chime in. Put them in their, for lack of a better term, put them in their place. Explain why these are in there to protect the spiders, not to rip you off, not to part you from your money, not to make you wait, or, you know, for your animals. It has nothing to do with that. It's trying to protect the animal. So if you're going to ship her in the winter, please do so respectfully, responsibly. Take the safety of the animal, make the safety of the animals paramount. Kind of stifle that urge to get your stuff immediately, and everybody will be happier overall. All right, moving on. Talking about winter, I just want to touch on this one before, because somebody emailed me the other day and said apparently they heard from somewhere else that I winterize my tarantulas by heating. It was some weird thing. Apparently somebody somewhere heard my podcast. I did a podcast about quote-unquote winterizing my slings, which I just kind of threw the term out there because it's just something I do for my slings during the wintertime, which I'll explain briefly in a moment. But apparently this person was confused and thought I basically heated up my sling. Apparently somebody heard something secondhand and then commented on it and didn't even actually listen to the podcast, which is kind of irritating. But now there's misinformation out there about what I was saying. As far as the winterizing the slings, just to be clear, I really, all I do is when my slings in the wintertime, because the air does dry out much more quickly here. I do run a humidifier and that helps, but when it gets particularly cold outside, I do have an older home and the furnace is running, trying to keep up with it. And what happens is it dries out the air immensely. So even with the humidifier, things can get dry. And what happens is those little tiny sling enclosures, those evaporate very, very quickly. So if I have, say, the little dram bottles or even the Amac boxes, those are going to dry out a lot faster than, say, a big Sterilite container or a big aquarium or whatnot, because you can have, you know, obviously there's deeper substrate, there's more room for the water to soak down and it, for to retain the moisture, but those evaporate quickly. So what I do with slings is I have a bigger container, and this makes them easier to do feedings too, because you're not pulling a bunch of individual containers off the shelf, but I take a bigger container, I line the bottom of it with paper towels, I carefully put the little, you know, dram bottles, little Amac boxes, whatever inside. And then I put an open dish of water in the middle of it. Or like, usually what I do is put a bunch of holes and then burn a bunch of holes in the top of a 16-ounce deli cup and put really big holes in the top so that there's, you know, a lot of water going through. And I put that right in the middle, put the things around it. And I can also spray down the paper towels a little bit. And what happens is it just keeps the inside of that container a little more moist, adds a little more moisture to that so they don't evaporate so quickly. That's it. And I've used it for years. And I've heard people say, oh, I've never had to do anything like that. Whoop-de-doo, I'm glad. That's fine. I'm not telling anybody they have to do this. I'm telling you something I've done that has really helped me, because my house gets really dry in the wintertime, even with the humidity fire going. So just to clarify, I do not add extra heat to them. That seemed to be the thing where somebody was like, oh, he puts extra heat on. No, I don't. And it really bothered me only because I've never said that. And this is somebody else quoting me, having obviously never even listened to what I said, because that's not at all what I do. I just put them in a larger plastic container. I make sure there's cross ventilation, put those paper towels down, put that 16-ounce deli cup. I use the soldering iron to put the holes in. I make really good size, like over quarter-inch holes in the top, a bunch of them. So it really allows a lot of water to evaporate out into that. And what it does is just keeps the inside a little moister so they don't evaporate so quickly. And I find that works very well over the wintertime. I can sleep a little bit better. Even though I check on them constantly, that is a concern with slings. In the wintertime, where the air dries out really badly, it doesn't take long for those enclosures to dry out. And then it doesn't take long for your sling to dry out and die. So just a little peace of mind. Plus, again, the convenience of being able to pull the whole thing out at once. I sometimes use it in the summer, but I don't obviously put the water in it because we have high humidity here usually in the summer anyway. But it's just easier to pull out the whole tray, and then I'm feeding 10, 12, 14. At one point, I think I had 20-something slings in it, and they're all doing great because of it. So just to clarify, again, not to be redundant, but no heat. It's just an extra large container. Almost like what I do when I raise slings and I take out the eggs with legs. Kind of a similar premise where you have the water, you have them, except I put them in the deli cups. In this case, it's the same premise, just trying to keep the moisture level around those enclosures a little higher so they don't evaporate as quickly. So a little clarification there. If anybody else says anything about Tom or him making an incubator or heating, and please correct them, I do not do that. That's not at all what I said. And finally, moving on to our last quote-unquote mini topic, I just did a video where I did some updates on the first bioactive enclosures I put together, the BioDude. If you remember, the BioDude contacted me, said they would love to have me review some of this stuff, and I normally don't do stuff like this. It's very important for me that people understand that if I'm reviewing something, it's because I want to review it. I don't want special treatment from people, because obviously the review's useless if somebody knows that you have an audience and that you can get them, you know. The endorsement thing is kind of icky to me, and obviously I have this whole thing about Tom's Big Spiders and using it to make money. That's not what I'm doing this for. And I want people to know if I, you know, endorse something, it's legit. And that a lot of times, the running joke, and this has happened with a couple people that I now quite friendly with, but I ordered under usually a different email address so nobody knows it's me. I don't do the Tom's Big Spiders one because I want to see what the treatment's like. I want to see what any Joe Schmo would get. And mostly it's been all good, and I've been able to report that. And when I've gotten excellent service, I've reported that as well. So with the BioDude, he contacted me. I normally don't like to do stuff like that, but it was at a time where I was actually looking at doing bioactive enclosures, and he was going to send me everything I needed to hook one up and help me with some of the, you know, setups and everything, which he did, which was great. And I'm glad he did. Because since then, I have now ordered, I checked before this, I believe 8 more times from them. So I am legitimately using them. So I want to make that very clear, because I told somebody I use the substrate and they went, yeah, but you probably get it for free from endorsing them. No. I go back and order like everybody else. I have a code that I could give people that I haven't put out there that gives me points every time somebody goes and orders from them, but I just feel icky doing it. It's not about that. It's if I find something I like, I'm going to promote it. So anyway, quickly moving into the bioactives, I've had some people ask me where should they start if they want to do one. I'll tell you right off the bat, my quick, you know, 5-minute version of how to set one of these things up. You've seen the enclosure styles. You want to pick an enclosure that's going to allow you to, you know, put enough substrate in there to obviously maintain the plants. You want to find an appropriate substrate. Don't just start it off with cocoa fiber. I've had a couple people that are like, yeah, I just planted them in cocoa fiber. That's not really an appropriate soil for it, for these things to really work. I'm using the BioDude substrate. I love it. If you want to start with some, I mean, that's something I've used personally, can endorse, but I haven't tried a bunch of other ones. I've had other people say that other stuff work as well. I believe Any Hurt makes a substrate. ABS, I think, is the name of the one. I could be quoting this one wrong, but it's come up a couple times, and I do want to try it out and find it, but I've had a lot of people say they've used the ABS substrate before. It works great, but you want a rich soil for this. You don't want to just throw it into some cocoa fiber or something. Topsoil would probably, I guess it would work, but I would honestly go for a substrate made for bioactive enclosures, because they have stuff in it like charcoal. It's mixed in a way with the sand and everything else to really make it work well for the bioactive enclosures. And then as far as plants, here's my tip to you. Go pick up pothos. Pick up some type of pothos. The things are they grow fantastically well and under a variety of conditions. They're very easy to keep alive. I have, knock on wood, yet to kill a pothos. As a matter of fact, I've ended up even more pothos than I started with, because I trimmed some of them off, and you can basically stick them in water. They'll grow some roots, and you can plant new pothos. So that would be a good one if you just want to start out with a good, quick, and dirty bioactive enclosure. Because I've had a lot of people ask me, now that you've experimented a bit, what plants would you say? Pothos would be number one. Wandering Jew would be number two. Those seem to be almost unkillable. I will say I've had one that bloomed like it's like taking over the whole enclosure. It's amazing. And even the ones that haven't bloomed quite that much, they're doing so well that I've used them in just about every enclosure I have now that has bioactive. Sometimes I like to put two plants in, the Wandering Jew and pothos both. I've used other plants. I had good luck with one of the Fittonia, but the more people I talk to, the more that seem to have trouble with that. I've had terrible luck with Peperomia, and I've talked to some people. Apparently it's a plant that needs higher humidity on the outside, but also you can't allow the roots to get too moist, so you got to let it dry out in between. So there's kind of a like fine line you walk there. So if anybody has luck with those, please feel free to chime in, but I am not having any luck with those. So I would encourage anybody looking to do the bioactives, you're going to want it. You can buy the lights, you can go on Amazon, there are lights you can buy that have the blue and red spectrum, or the, you know, the plant lights. Some of the plant lights, you don't want the ones that look, have that purplish glow. I don't have those, but I got ones that are very bright, and those will help. But I will say that the pothos with some indirect sunlight do fine. So do the Wandering Jews. You want your substrate, and then you want leaf litter. Don't forget your leaf litter. The BioDude does have the BioShot stuff that you add to it that supposedly introduces some of those, you know, the good fungi, the good bacteria that will help maintain that bioactive setup. Because in theory, what's going to happen in that setup, things are going to decompose, break down, and rot, and that adds food for the plant. So it's like a little ecosystem in there. So it's not just putting them in dirt and going, ah, we're done. You allow the breakdown, natural breakdown of the leaf litter, the sphagnum, whatever's in there, to actually feed the plants. And then springtails, those are always good to add, because you are going to be adding some moisture in there. So I found overall it's not, for people that want to give this a try, start simple. I jumped in the deep end, had a bunch of different plants and had, you know, varying success with them. But I would say start with a pothos, start with a Wandering Jew, grab your substrate, grab your leaf litter, have it on hand, set up your enclosure. And then the one thing I would encourage people to do, let the plants settle in a bit. That's where I screwed up to begin with, where I just kind of immediately started dropping spiders in. And I think that's where I lost some plants. Give them time to let the plant get the hang of keeping that enclosure at a, you know, the optimal conditions for that plant to grow. Make sure it takes hold, those roots dig in, and then add your spider afterwards. So that's like my quick down and dirty, because a lot of people have been asking me, if I want to jump in, what do I do? That's what you need. And the enclosure is another thing too. The ExoTerra ones work really well. Sometimes they've got some other ones out there, the glass enclosures, those work really well. And the good thing is, you do want ventilation. This is the question that's come up quite a bit. You do want ventilation, but depending on the plants you produce, keep in mind also that there's going to be some oxygenation in there just from the plants, which is awesome, which is the thing I like about it, because it's like a natural, a real environment where you might even end up with a more oxygen-rich environment than you normally would have had you not done a bioactive enclosure, because of the plants being in there. So anyway, that's just a quick down and dirty, because I've had a couple people ask me about them, and I did do the whole update. I thought I did an update podcast one on those. I can't remember, but I just did an update on the first four I planted. Three of them are going really well. One of them, the one I did with the old Philippinus, did not do well at all. I had a Croton, I believe it's pronounced. Is that how it's pronounced? I'm still having a hard time with the names in there. And I also had a spider plant. The croton was doing great, and then it was dead. It was like literally within 3 days, there wasn't a leaf on the branch. I don't know what the heck I did to it. I was so upset, too. It was like almost like the same feeling when I see a spider sick. Like, what am I doing? What am I doing wrong? And then the spider plant was doing eh. But my O. philippinus female decided that was the spot she wanted to use to create her egg sac and her little lair for where she rolled the egg and basically demolished the whole thing. So that one's dead too. So we've started off with a pothos in that one. That's about it now. I do want to stick something in the corner where the spider plant was, but that'll be down the road. So overall, loving the bioactives. I've had a couple people ask. I will do a bigger update coming up, but I just wanted to throw this out there because I know some people are starting to look, and that would be my tip to you guys. Buy the fixings. Those are the important fixings that you're going to need. If you have a place where you get natural sunlight, you might be able to do without the lights. I have the lights in my room because I have a lot of bioactives now, and they don't seem to bother the spiders. Some of them come out. I actually have ones now that come out and sit right in the light. My GBB sits right out underneath the light, doesn't mind at all, which is neat because they never did that before. So you may see some more different behaviors, more interesting behaviors than you've seen before. I've also found that with the plants, some of them, it allows them to venture out more. You see them more. So something to think about. But anyway, we'll do a larger update on that in the future. I just wanted to touch base because I've had a couple people ask. Now, moving on to this is going to be a long one because this interview was like, I think, over 50 minutes. So we're going to be doing a long podcast today. But again, I wanted to present it for people that didn't have the opportunity to pop over and check it out on his podcast. And I do hope that some of you check it out because he really is. I'm actually listening to him now because he's dude's incredibly bright. He's very articulate. I mean, Dylan's just a great overall guy and has one of those minds, I think, very like-minded in a sense that he likes to look at all angles of things. He doesn't jump on one side or the other. He presents both angles. And I love that because that is so tough to find in any hobby because it doesn't matter if it's tarantulas, you know, fish, reptiles, there are going to be people out there that it's this way or you're doing it completely wrong. And he has that open-mindedness where he's able to kind of dig down into like, all right, what are both sides of this, which I absolutely love. He was a great interviewer. Again, I'm hoping I can get him to get a tarantula so we'll find a way to get him on here at one point anyway because it was just an effortless conversation. I'd love to, you know, interview him. He'd be a great one to talk to and work with on it. But hopefully we can get him to get a tarantula so then we can really talk about his movement into that because I think it would be neat for somebody. It's been so long since I've had snakes that I don't remember a lot of that transition because it was a transition from one type of animal to another, but he's obviously fresh into the reptile hobby, so it'd be neat to kind of hear about it as it goes. So anyway, without further ado, here is my interview with Animals at Home. This is going to be a long one, so for those of you that have already listened to this and don't want to, you can go ahead and turn it on now unless you really want to hear me drone on again, or you can go through and try to find the species I make up in the middle of the interview. So I'll be back at the end of this to close it out, and here's the interview.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
I am not in the tarantula world at all, so I'm definitely excited to have a conversation that's outside of my comfort zone. And you're also one of the listeners that actually recommended you as a guest, so I'm happy to fulfill those requests whenever they come in. And you and I actually have a similar start to our respective hobbies, and that it took me about 8 years to add a second animal to my collection, and then I have six now, so I haven't expanded it like crazy. You've taken it to another level by taking 16 years to add your second spider, and now you have over 100. So I really want to understand how that happened. But let's start with the first one. How did the first one enter your life?
Well, the first one, I actually started off as arachnophobic, and I grew up in my house. We had lots of animals. We grew up on a farm, but my mom drew the line. As far as pets were concerned, there were no exotics. So we had goats, sheep, you name a farm animal. We had it. We had sometimes goats in our dining room. We weren't allowed to have spiders or snakes specifically. And I wanted both. So when Billy and I first moved out years ago, the first thing we did was went out and started buying snakes. And I found a local guy who was a Marine that was selling tarantulas. And he had what we referred to as the Rosie, with rose-haired tarantula, which is one of, back in those days, probably the most popular as far as pet tarantulas are concerned. And I bought her from him. She was a little 4-inch. I didn't know female, male. I knew nothing about these at the time. And it was partly due to the fact that I was arachnophobic and it had become kind of silly for me being, you know, I had a buddy I worked with and we did landscaping once and he had a garden spider on his shovel and he was about to put his hand on it and I couldn't get out of my mouth, there is a spider on the shovel, because I was so terrified thinking about it. And we got made fun of by our boss because two big dudes out there working on stuff and I was screaming when he put his hand on it. So I'm like, I got to get over this. And with spiders, I had always been raised that, you know, they weren't something you killed. You have a lot of people, it's like, you know, they do the burn it, squish it. That was never my mentality. They were always considered to be, you know, important to the ecosystem, important, you know, when you grow up on a farm, they're killing the bugs you don't want around. So I was never fearful in a way that I wanted to kill them, but I was very fascinated by them at the same time. And I wanted to learn more about them. So we picked up this one. I actually had two when I started off. Another one was a zebra knee or a Fontopelma cimani. And that one ended up being a mature male that I bought at a show. And mature males don't last as long. So this thing died pretty quickly. I blame myself. Didn't figure out years later that I had a male. And then we had the one that we now refer to as the queen. And she is still with us. It's been, oh gosh, I lose track, around 24 years we've had her.
That's amazing.
And and it's one of the things I never expected to have her that long. You got her. She was one of the oddities of my collection, because back that time we were more into snakes. I had almost 40 snakes. But she was kind of the star of the show, because everybody was so sick of seeing the snakes all around that they'd come over and be like, all right, break out the tarantula. And my buddy, the one that was afraid of spiders with me, was, you know, would come over and would feed her. But, you know, as time went on, she molted, got a little bit bigger. And then it was after 16 years that we were talking about the fact that this spider had been with us for, at this point, it was several dogs, because I have dogs. We had been through two different apartments, two different houses, you know, a lot of things, and kind of got sentimental about it. So I decided I was going to hop online and see if there was possibly a way, you know, what was going on out there as far as tarantulas. Back when I first got her, there wasn't, you know, the internet wasn't a big thing. You didn't order them online. You went to local shows. In the state I live in, Connecticut, they're illegal to sell in public. You can buy them, you can own them, you can't sell them at a pet store in an expo. So I basically hopped online. I remember hopping online, going tarantulas for sale, and just seeing what came up. And it was probably a good hour of just looking at all the pictures of species. I found blue ones. I thought they were Photoshopped. I'm like, there's no way there's blue spiders. That doesn't make any sense. And my wife, who's been with me for a long time, put up with a million of my hobbies over the years, it probably knew right then it was starting to heat up. And I turned to her at one point and I'm like, you know what? I can see myself probably realistically having like 25 to 30 of these something. Now, I think last count, we're at about 175.
Oh my God.
So it definitely blew up. But the big thing with the hobby, and a lot of people that get into the hobby, and it's neat because I've been doing this for long enough that people that just started off years ago, they were buying their first spider, like, hey, Tom, I'm only getting one. And my big joke is always, watch out, you know, next thing you know, you'll have 100. And I can't tell you how many people that, you know, 4 years ago had only one get back to me and they're like, now I have 100. They're incredibly addictive. There's different personalities, different types, different, you know, a lot of the colors are just amazing. And that's one of the biggest things I've learned with trying to talk to people about tarantulas, because I teach, and it has gotten out that, you know, I'm the weird guy that has tarantulas, and I recognize that it's a fringe hobby. I recognize that many people would find keeping that many spiders in their home on purpose to be a nightmare and ridiculous and weird. So I try to like win them over a little bit by showing them pictures of all the different colors. And I think that's kind of the gateway for a lot of people. It's almost like tropical fish. You get a goldfish, and next thing you know, you're looking at other fish. You start looking at the aesthetics of them, the colors. You start looking at how you can set them up. And suddenly it's like, all right, you go from one tank with a few fish in it to now I have two tanks. Now I have five tanks. So same kind of principle. And I think the ease of care and the fact that they don't need huge areas to roam around helps a lot too.
Yeah. I mean, as a snake hobbyist or reptile hobbyist, it's so easy for me to understand how someone could fall into the tarantula mm-hmm. hobby. Like, it just makes perfect sense to me. But you're totally right. Like, the average person can't understand snakes, and even nope. more so can't understand spiders. So when you first got like the initial one, was there still like some fear and hesitation with this? Like, how scared were you?
Incredibly scared. And a story I like to tell, because I have a lot of people that approach me and they were like embarrassed. Like, they haven't heard my older stuff and realize that I started off incredibly arachnophobic. I got it from my mom. She's the one, she wouldn't let us have it because she's incredibly arachnophobic as well. But I like to tell the story that after keeping her for many years, I decided I was going to handle her, because one of the misconceptions with the tarantula hobby is you have to handle. And that's not true. I'm not going to tell people you can't, and a lot of people do, but it's not necessary to actually enjoy the hobby. It's kind of, again, like the fish analogy. You wouldn't pick up your goldfish and hold it. Same thing for a lot of people. So I, at that time, thought, I can't really call myself a tarantula person if I don't hold this thing. That was one of the points of getting it, was to help me get over my fear. So I got it one night in my snake room. I had a room with all the snakes. I took her down, put her on the floor, opened her enclosure, and I had a glove on in one hand, and I took a paintbrush in the other, just like I had learned that you were supposed to do. And I put my hand down, and when I went to touch the back of her with the brush, she wheeled on the brush, and I felt her fangs scrape on the metal part of the brush. Passed out, woke up, don't know how long it was later, but literally sitting on the floor, sweating, slumped over, I didn't even know where I was from it. And I looked down, and she was perched right on the side of the enclosure. And I'm like, all right. So I took the cap, kind of got her back in, walked downstairs and immediately walked up the building. I'm like, I think I just passed out trying to hold the queen. Like, it was mortifying at the time. So that was several years, probably 10 years after having her. And still at that point, that set me back a long time. And that's one of the reasons why when people are talking about, I need the handle, don't rush it, because one bad experience, it was a feeding response. She wasn't at all going at me because she was trying to hurt me. She thought when she felt that paintbrush touch the webbing underneath her, as far as she knew, it was a cricket. She was getting fed. I'd never stuck my hand in there before. So she went for it. But yeah, it took a while. And then after I started getting really into the hobby and buying more, I do a lot of rehousing videos now to help people. I find they get over their fear when they watch somebody do it and it goes smoothly. Not the train wreck ones that tend to get all the views, but the ones where the spider goes from point A to point B with no issues. And I do a lot of those. My earlier rehousings, I'm glad I didn't tape them, because you could tell I was terrified. Like little teeny slings, it would start to climb out like, oh God, because at that point they look like little house spiders. The tiny spiderlings are tiny, they look like house spiders. So it did take me quite a while. I remember the first time a spider started to get out of like the enclosure I was putting in, and it was a docile species. And without even thinking, I just stuck my hand out to get it. And it wasn't until afterwards, like, my God, like 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I would never have been able to do that. I would have freaked. So it's finally to the point now that, you know, when they do therapy and they, like, I've actually been talked to by therapists who are trying to get a tarantula to help people get over, where they do that kind of exposure therapy. For me, once you get surrounded by them day in and day out, it really did help desensitize myself to it. I almost miss it in a way, because I miss some of that awe that I used to get when I would look at, like, oh my gosh, this is a big giant spider. Now it's like, yeah, it's a tarantula, a little fuzzy animal.
Right. Yeah, it's such amazing that you put yourself in that hobby and you were that afraid of it. Like, that's it's the opposite of what most people would do.
Yeah. And for me, it was a lot of, I'm an animal lover, always have been, love, you know, and again, a lot of people think immediately you're into spiders, you're not into the fuzzy animals. I have four dogs I absolutely adore. They're surprised we haven't heard them yet. So I love all animals, and it really bothered me that something that I was that fascinated by, that I was scared of, and I recognized it as an irrational fear. But again, if you have a phobia of something, there's nothing rational about it. It was more about me trying to confront that. And then as I'm confronting it, realizing, all right, these things are really cool. The snakes, when I got into snakes, there was never a fear of snakes whatsoever. I've never had a fear of snakes, no issues handling them, anything like that. So that was different. With the tarantulas, it was that getting over the fear while at the same time discovering just an incredibly cool animal that I could keep and learn more about.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about your rehoming videos, and those are fascinating for me to watch. Cause for me too, I don't know if I would pass out if a spider touched me, but it would be pretty close. Cause my mom also an arachnophobe, yep. And I'm sure that has, you know, instilled in me in some way. And like you were saying, there's so many videos out there, like spider, you know, escapes and kills the whole family and whatnot. But watching your rehoming videos, it's just so calm and you don't have to touch them. And that's a lot more appealing for someone who is fascinated, but doesn't want to have to, you know, touch it. And you don't actually have to touch it.
No, you don't. And I think that's a very important thing. And I think the coolest thing that's come out of this, because the rehousing videos, for me, when I started on YouTube, I never meant to be a personality. My daughter kind of encouraged me to do it. And a lot of my earlier videos were either just fun things I would show my family. There's like ones out there, terrible feeding videos with just like hardcore heavy metal music in the background, something I probably would not do now. But back then it was funny. Like, hey, look at this thing's eating. But I started doing the videos, the rehousing videos specifically to kind of back up what I was talking about on my blog, because picture's worth 1,000 words. So sitting there talking about something's one thing, but being able to go, all right, and here's one of my rehousings with this species. That's how it kind of all came about. And I never anticipated that those were going to become some of the most popular ones I do, but I've spoken to so many people now that say, you know what, I bought this species, I went online, I looked up YouTube videos, there's a, you know, one with a kid with an OBT, for example, considered to be one of the nastier species, with it running all around his room and they're trying to catch it and it's getting out and it's a really dangerous situation. And people watch that and they're like, this is what I have to look forward to, forget it. And the person's like, you know, I saw this video and then I watched yours and you just calmly picked her up and put her in a new enclosure and it was fine. And that means a lot, because I'm not trying to sensationalize them. I'm more for educating and trying to help people that were maybe in the same situation I was in, where they're fascinated by them, but they're afraid of them. And to be able to show, look at, you can work with them easily. Things can go very, very well without having one of these, you know, train wreck type escapes or something like that.
Yeah, I do really think that we're still in such an early phase with, YouTube in general, even though it's been around for a while, it's still pretty new, that I'm hoping that the sensationalized things start to wean themselves off, because like you said, and I'm the same way. I don't try to go crazy and do wild videos. It's just, I feel like good content should eventually outweigh sensationalized, you know, whatever they're putting on there.
I agree 100%. And the problem is, it comes down to, and that's what I've realized with my channel, and you know, a lot of people fixate on growth. I don't, I answer every single comment. For me, it's more like a give and take thing. And if I got huge as some of these people, it would drive me nuts. I wouldn't be able to answer everything. So for me, it's like I attract people that are looking for good information. They're interested in the hobby already. There's already an interest there. Most of my people, I should say. And they're looking for somebody that they can trust, because there's a lot of conflicting information out there about how to keep them, especially if you started a pet store. A lot of people go to pet stores. The information they give is just horrifically bad. And I think they're, unfortunately, as far as mainstream, like a lot of the channels that blow up, especially folks that do stuff like you and I do, it's that sensationalized video that goes viral, that somebody's like, oh my gosh, my, you know, giant 10-inch spider jumped off, like you said before, and ate my face. And people click that don't want anything. And you get a lot, you look at the comments and it's burn it, kill it. Nope. I don't get very many of those, because I think the majority of people that are gravitating toward mine recognize there's more of a maturity about it. It's not about me. It's not about me putting on a show. It's about, here are these animals. Here's how you take care of them correctly. And so sadly, I do think some of these channels are like ours are starting to pick up a little bit, but I think there's always going to be that sensationalistic route where you put in, you know, it's a train wreck and people just gravitate toward it because it's fun. It's like, yeah, nobody wants to hear me drone on for a half an hour about tarantula husbandry when we can watch one running around somebody's room. That's just more entertaining. It's like, yeah, watching NASCAR for the accidents or hockey for the fights. You know, it's, you're missing the point.
Yeah, exactly. And you hope that the people that actually, I mean, and that's what happens. The people that actually want the animal gravitate towards the content like yours, and then they learn. So how did, I mean, you're saying you kind of started with the just, you know, video, family sort of videos originally, but how did the blog start, or what motivated you to do that?
The blog was kind of funny, because it actually, I share this now, but it started almost as a joke with me and my family. My wife and I go on long walks every day, and she's the one that has to come home and pretend like she's interested in all my hobbies, and she does an amazing job of it. Like, I think she legitimately is, especially with the tarantulas now, but a lot of times it's like, all right, here's the newest thing I'm talking about. So there was a lot of me talking about all this stuff, because when I get into something new, it's that learning part is the fun part for me. I know a lot of people, the learning part is, and that's, I think, one of the problems we have in the hobby. For some people, that's not the case. They want everything hand fed to them, you know, right away. They just, this is how do you do it. I don't want to do any work. I love that. I love learning new things. I love researching. I actually enjoyed the fact that a lot of the stuff I was finding was contradictory, because then I have to do a little digging and figuring out, you know, which is the real thing, which is not. So for me, it started off as kind of, you know what, I'm going to start a little blog, and I'm going to call it, originally it was going to be Tom's Tarantulas. And we giggled and like, that is so lame, it's ridiculous. And then I made it even lamer, and we went with Tom's Big Spiders, and we all giggled and it was like the funniest thing ever. I'm like, can you imagine? So when it started off, it was more me just kind of posting like, here's my spider that molted here, just kind of getting it out of my system so poor Billy didn't have to listen to it all the time. Although then I'd make her read the article. So really didn't win out
edit
there.
This. Yeah.
Yeah. Edit, yeah, exactly. Like, can you go through this and tell me how it is?
Yeah.
But then what ended up happening is I did a couple. I was on a board called the Arachnoboards, which is a fantastic place to find information, but it can be very, very, especially back then, very hostile toward people that are new to the hobby. And what will happen is people will ask questions that, you know, they genuinely want to know what's going on, and it's new to them, so they don't realize it's a question that's been asked a lot of times before. And I was privy to one situation where somebody went on, and I thought it was a young woman that had asked a genuine question. It was a good question that I teach. You know, we talk about the fact there's no such thing as a stupid question. And just got totally destroyed by the folks on the board. You should be doing your homework. You should be doing this. You shouldn't have the spider. You should sell the spider before you kill it. And the woman basically ended by going, you know what? I'm done with this place. I came here for to ask a question. I was torn apart, closed up her account, and walked away without getting an answer to her question. And I thought that was pretty bad. And again, I'm not disparaging that. The board's amazing and has a lot of great people and a lot of great info. But any public forum, whether it be Facebook or a message board, you're going to have the bad apples. And so at that point is when I started, I took a turn, and I'm like, you know what? I enjoy writing. I enjoy teaching. Maybe I could turn this, you know, website, this kind of fun little, like, look, here's my tarantula journey, into something a little with a little more substance. So I started kind of just reporting things I had seen and observed. My big thing was, instead of just going, this is how they keep them, it was species I was keeping and sharing all the observations that I got of them, so that when somebody got one, they'd know exactly what to expect. And little by little, it was funny because at first it was like, I'd pull up the thing and you can monitor your stats, and I'd go, look at, I got a view today. And there'd be my daughter on her Kindle. And then one day I remember I was trying to hit, my big thing is I wanted to hit 25 views. It was like a joke. I'm going to hit 25 views today. And there's Billy and my daughter and my son over in the other room, secretly on the computers, clicking on it to try to make it look like I'm getting the views. But then little by little, they weren't doing that and the views were coming in. So it was kind of like, all right, people are actually listening to this. This is good. And then it became kind of like a responsibility. It's like, all right, enough of the foofy stuff. Let's make this even more serious. So that's where it really turned into like, all right, as a beginner, if they're going to stumble on my site, what does a beginner need? What type of information are they going to be looking for? And the nice thing is, the more people that I interacted with, the more material I had, because I was getting those questions directly from the people that were looking for them. So it kind of made it very easy to go, all right, we have a bunch of people that want to know what a good beginner species is. There's a lot of conflicting information. I'll do an article on that. We have people that are fixating on the fact they think they have to keep their tarantula super humid. They don't. Let's work on that. So it kind of developed out of that, and amazingly found an audience that I still can't believe that it found, because I never thought in a million years. The running joke was, you know, I told my wife at one point that, years from now, this is going to be like the top tarantula website. It was totally a joke. It wasn't a cocky thing. It was like, ha, ha, ha. And lo and behold, it does get a lot of traffic now. And I get a lot of people that find me from that site.
Yeah. No, and it's awesome that you can show people, like you were talking about, when you get into a new hobby, it's so exciting and you love the learning. And there are tons of people out there like that. And it's showing people that that's actually what the hobby's for, like giving you an outlet to learn and try new things and just experiment. And I always say the animal's like the cherry on top. So you know, there's people that want the cookie cutter, like give me everything I need to know so I can look at the spider. Yep. It's like, you actually want to enjoy the process. And if you don't enjoy that process, you should go look at spiders in the zoo or the pet store. And then, or if you do enjoy it, then go ahead and jump into the hobby. And I think that's what you show really nicely.
And that means a lot, because that's exactly what I'm going for. And it's like, I state ad nauseum, part of the hobby, like people are like, what do I need to know? Well, first and foremost, you need to do some research. You need to look around. I encourage people all the time, don't just listen to me. I mean, I'd like to think my information is on point. I do a lot of research. I talk to a lot of people. I'm always trying to monitor if anything's changed to make sure they're getting the most current stuff. But just don't take my word for it. Go out there, go on Arachnoboards, do a search, go on the Facebook group, see what they say. But I couldn't agree more. I don't understand the mentality. I don't judge, but I don't understand the mentality. I'm going to buy an animal. I'm just going to set it up any darn way I want. I'm not going to do any research. I'm not going to learn anything about it. Usually those people, unfortunately, that's the one where the novelty wears off and they're stuck there with an animal that's completely languishing in a terrible cage with not getting proper treatment. And that's sad to me. And unfortunately, I think with exotics, and I'm sure you've experienced this as well, we do attract that crowd sometime that it's a novelty to them. Like there's not really a love for the animal. It's, I want something cool that I can play with and show off to my friends. But when it comes down to it, that eventually wears off. And if you're not into the hobby to a sense where you're going to do research and try to upgrade your enclosure and try to improve things, then what do?
Exactly.
So it becomes, that's probably the toughest part for me doing this, is I am privy to some of those situations where people will, you know, my favorite is, I do these videos, I try to put as many notes in as possible to help people, like any question you could possibly ask, it'll be answered. And somebody will come on and go, great video. Can you please tell me what you know about this species? And it's like, dude, this is a 10-minute video. Everything's in it. And I'll go, oh, did you watch the video? Oh, no, I didn't have the time. Could you tell me? It's like, those are the people that sometimes confound me, because it's like, all right, you're in the wrong hobby. Go get a goldfish or, something that actually, don't get any animals. Just stay away. Like you said, go to the zoo or admire them in a pet store.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have to enjoy the process, and it's super important. And especially because, I mean, I was surprised and realized how long that some tarantulas live for. Like, this is not a short commitment.
No, it's a huge commitment. We have ones that we jokingly call legacy tarantulas, and those are the ones that, you know, I joke I'm going to be leaving to my grandkids. I mean, I have one now. I bought a Sling G. Porteri, which is a rose hair, and I believe it's been 6 years. I got her. She was a third of an inch. Now, after 6 years, she's a whopping about inch and a quarter. And that's with ideal, you know, they've got quote unquote ideal temps, because they're not going through, you know, Chilean winters or anything like that. Nice warm temps all the time, just grows at a glacially slow pace. So that's a spider that I've probably got another at least 5 years before she's an adult. And then she's going to go on for probably another 20, 30 years after that.
That's amazing. That's So it's not a short commitment for sure.
Not at all.
So with tarantulas, you're going to deal with like the people's gut reaction initially is, I hate that. Is there certain things that win people over? I know you were talking about the pictures and whatnot and colors. Are there other things that, you know, if someone comes over to your house, they can leave thinking, okay, tarantulas are maybe not as bad as I originally thought?
It's tricky. It depends. I found it depends on the individual. A lot of people have that facade where they're just like, I'm not going to hear it. I don't want to hear it. But usually you can break them down. Pictures, I do believe, is probably one of the biggest. Not even videos right off the bat, because they move. And I've noticed that people freak out like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. And then it moves and they freak out. And they're not looking at the video anymore. Sometimes breaking out the molts is a point of interest, because it's, you know, the molts look exactly like the spider. Oh God, Billy's sitting over here. We have probably hundreds of molts around the house because I just can't throw them away. They're amazing looking, but sometimes breaking those out help. I have certain species that I can break out. We had a YouTuber come over this summer who wanted to get over his fear of tarantulas, and he contacted me and he came over with his girlfriend, and we broke out the species called Homeoma chilensis, or the Chilean flame. It's a tiny little dwarf tarantula, and I swear it's the friendliest thing you will ever meet in your life. And this one tends to win people over because it's smaller, and you can see, like, I don't use the word friendly very much with tarantulas, because they're, first and foremost, they're wild animals. They will tolerate, most of them will tolerate, or some of them will tolerate handling, but they're not enjoying it. It's not like your dog that's going to come over and you're going to scratch his head and it's going to love it. It's going to tolerate it. This one actually seems to appreciate it. If you open up the cage, and I've heard this from hundreds of keepers, they will come climbing out right into the palm of your hand and just sit there. So that's one that's kind of a nice little gateway one, because they see it, they watch it come out on its own. It appears to be quote unquote friendly, and that helps warm people up to them a little bit. The pitchers is the big one though, because I have found, and it took me years to figure this out, when I would say I have, you know, back in the day, I have 50 tarantulas, they automatically picture a bunch of big brown hairy spiders. They have no idea the colors they come in. And when you start showing some of the colors, that's when you first see that repulsion kind of morph into more of, whoa, hey, curiosity, I'm interested, tell me a little more. And then they'll usually, it's funny because the discussion always goes the same. They're disgusted, then they're kind of like, ooh, and then they get disgusted again, but then they ask another question. They're like, well, how did they get bigger? They molt. And then you start to see them kind of rope, you know, you rope them in. So a lot of it is kind of enkindling that fascination that I think even some of the most arachnophobic people have if you approach it the right way. The way not to do it is to immediately say, hey, hold this. I've heard people like, oh yeah, just hold it. No, it's something you've got to kind of slowly get them used to. So I think a lot of it, pictures are huge. Once you get off the pictures, some of the videos, seeing particular spiders, watching them move slowly, not be scary, sometimes helps. Molts is a good one too. I mean, it's tricky though, because for me now, I've become detached to that feeling to a point where sometimes it is hard for me to remember what it was like to be that terrified of them. So I have to kind of put myself in their shoes and realize, all right, to me, this is just a molt. To them, this looks like a giant dead spider. So it's tricky. You have to feel the people out. I will tell you, the YouTuber that came over, I don't want to blow his spot yet because he hasn't posted the video yet, but he wasn't able, his whole goal was to handle one. He wanted to get over it. And I tried to explain, listen, it took me years to get to that point. If you can get even close to it and sit in proximity, that's a huge accomplishment. And he did. He went to the point, he wanted to touch it beforehand, and he reached over, and as soon as he touched it, he screamed, he was done. And I'm like, all right, there we go. That's over. You're not doing it. But his girlfriend, who was sitting there the whole time holding the camera for him, was like, can I try it? Sat down, held it, and was enamored with it. And it was neat because she wasn't obviously as afraid as he was. But you could see that kind of transition from, all right, this is kind of creepy, to, oh, this is interesting, to at the end, she's like, I'm going to have to get one of these, which is amazing. And it doesn't usually happen that quickly all the time, but it was amazing to watch.
Yeah. So it's almost like a combination of, one, fostering their curiosity, and two, yes, not forcing anything on them.
That's the big part. I think that's the perfect way to put it, is getting that curiosity, but not pushing them too hard, too fast. Cause that, again, the setbacks can be terrible.
You might pass out.
Exactly. That's a worst case. Or, you know, I tell people, it's funny, and I passed out. Had it bit me, I probably wouldn't be sitting here right now. That would have been, I would have been terrified of it. I don't think I would have gotten into them again. And so that's a make it or break it moment. So yes, it turned out okay. I passed out. I can giggle about it. But if you push somebody too hard and something goes wrong, like God forbid that spider had crawled up his arm or something, that would have been it. I would have set him back.
Totally, completely. So let's talk about a little bit in your collection. Obviously, we cannot have a podcast of going through every animal, but you have quite a large collection at this point. What are some of the species, just kind of off the top of your head, some of the favorites that you have in the collection right now?
Well, my all-time favorite is the Queen, which is the one I addressed before. She's probably, we're pushing, I'm guessing, in her 30s now. I mean, considering how long it took that sling to reach an inch and a quarter, you know, you're talking several years to reach an inch and a quarter. She was wild caught. I'm pretty positive of that. So she's an old girl, easily my favorite. We get this, you know, a lot of people like you to do lists of your favorite spiders. That's a big popular one, especially if you're on YouTube and people go on and usually, you know, a lot of people like, yay, and other people get mad at you because you didn't include theirs. And people are usually like, they'll always do the, what is the one spider you would keep if you only keep one? It would be her by far. I mean, and they're not, they've fallen out of favor over the years. They were considered to be one of the best beginners for many, many years. And it was mostly due to availability and the fact they were so cheap. Now that Chile is not exporting them out anymore, so the only ones we have in the hobby are captive bred, and they're harder to come by, so they're more pricey. And they're not really the best beginner species for many people, but that would be my top. I love the genus Pisolatheria, which are the parachute spiders. I'm terrible with the common names. I tried to review some before we got on because I realized people are going to be like, what is he talking about? But if you look up pokies, Google and Google them, they're a large, very sleek, lithe arboreal tarantula. They're gorgeous. They get a terrible rep because the venom, they are an old world species, and those are species from like Africa, Europe, India. They have more potent venom. That's their defense mechanism. So a bite from a pokey or a Pisolatheria species is not a pleasant experience. They won't kill you. No tarantula bites will kill you. But people have reported wanting to be dead for a little while because they're so bad. But unfortunately, because of this venom, they've become demonized in the hobby. And a lot of it's due to experienced keepers who don't want them falling in the hands of somebody that's just getting in the hobby, possibly getting bitten and bringing negative attention to the hobby. Because you could see it, we take one good news article, you know, boy in Missouri bitten by a deadly tarantula almost dies. And next thing you know it, there's all types of prohibitive legislation against them, which I do believe is, you know, it's important to protect and inform beginners. But I think it went overboard to the point where I have people that still go on, watch me rehouse these guys, watch how gentle they are, watch how shy really they are and how beautiful they are, and say, yeah, I don't know how you can keep those things in your house. Like, that's irresponsible. It's really sad. But easily, like, as far as genera of tarantulas, those guys, I love it. It'd be hard to pick just one. They're just gorgeous species. Another one, Formictopus, which is from the islands like the Dominican Republic, Haiti. Beautiful, big terrestrial spiders. These guys get like 7, sometimes 8 inches, come in colors like bronze. I have ones that literally look like they are forged from gold. I have one that is lavender and purple. Just absolutely beautiful spiders, great eaters, always visible. These are ones I kind of championed when I got early into the hobby. One of the things I started doing is recognizing that some species of tarantulas were getting overlooked, and they were gorgeous because people would just think, oh, it's a big brown spider. So when I picked these up, the first one I picked up, it's Haitian brown, I believe is the common name, which is a terrible common name because they're rarely ever brown. But I remember looking at it and Haitian brown, big brown tarantula, kind of ornery, kind of has an attitude. And I'm like, why would I want to get that thing? Well, I finally took a chance on them and it was like huge as far as just such a cool spider, huge growth. I mean, one thing that really will amaze people that haven't spent time with spiders before is how much growth they put on when they molt. When they molt, they basically pull out of their old exoskeleton, they have their new one underneath it, and the amount of size that they can put on in between those molts, it's just, you look at the old molt and you look at the new spider and wonder how it fit in there. And this is one of these species, the first one that molted, I was like, I called Billy and I'm like, you got to look at the size of this thing. There's this little like 2.5 inch molt and there's this big giant hairy tarantula, and I couldn't figure out how it came from that. So that's easily one of my favorite genera as well. Those two are just awesome spiders, but it's hard to pick overall favorites because it drives me nuts because sometimes I'll be on message boards and people will go, hey, tell us what tarantula you hate or which is your least favorite. And I just don't get that mentality because if I picked it up, I'm interested in it. And I've really never had anything that I just went, oh God, I hate you. I'm going to get rid of you. It's they're always cool. They all have their different. And one thing I've learned over the years, which I never would have believed, you know, 10 years ago, is that a lot of them do have their own distinct personalities. You see different things, weird behaviors that you don't, there's a purpose for it, but you can't figure it out. But I trying to pick top ones is really difficult because they're all so darn cool.
Is there, in terms of the differences between old world and new world, is it mostly just the potency of the venom? I think the new worlds are the ones that kick their hairs. And yep. Is there anything else?
No, that's the big one. The new worlds, the ones from, you know, North America, South America, surrounding islands, their defense mechanism is urticating or irritating hairs. And like you said, they kick them from their abdomen. Now, the problem is some people will poo-poo that, like, oh, it's just hairs. If you've been haired before, it's not a pleasant experience. And different species have different potencies as far as, you know, their hairs. So, for example, the Goliath bird eater, the T. blondii, it's, you know, everybody sees the big giant spiders are amazing, and the hairs are ridiculously nasty. There are people that can't keep them because the hairs are so nasty. And then the old world species, those are the ones that they tend to be much quicker, much more defensive. And I don't use the word aggressive because they're not going to hunt you down and try to kill your family. If you open up their enclosure and they feel like they're caught out in the middle of nowhere and threatened, then they will use a bite because it's going to hurt you. But they're the ones with the worst venom. And the problem is tarantula bites won't kill you. And I've read articles, I've reviewed articles before where people have talked about, you know, you could die from this, and it drives me nuts because there's, I believe, been 3 recorded deaths, and one of them, the person was bit in the back of the neck. It was a child and it was extenuating circumstances. I believe the other two, it was gangrene from the actual puncture wound, because it does create a puncture wound, but the venom, it's not deadly to man. But with those old world species, sometimes they're sold at pet stores and at expos, and people look online, they see somebody handling a tarantula, they go, oh, this orange one here, this is beautiful, I'm going to bring this home and handle it, not realizing that thing could put them in the hospital. So yeah, it's mostly the venom, but also the attitude that comes with the venom, because a new world species, they know, they've been programmed to recognize the bite really isn't going to do as much as kicking those hairs in the predator's nose or eyes. That's not their go-to. With the defensive old world species, that's their go-to defense. If they get cornered, there's no hairs to kick. They're going to turn around, they're going to throw a threat posture up, and then they're going to try to tag you.
So in terms of the hairs, what type of, is it mostly like kind of like a rash or a itchy reaction type thing?
It can be. I used to work in fiberglass for years, so anybody that's done anything with fiberglass insulation, the mild species, it feels a lot like that. I mean, it's like a flashback to me. Every once in a while, I'll do cleanings, and what will happen is people don't realize that they don't necessarily only kick their hairs when disturbed. They will use the hairs around their enclosures. They will use their hairs. They'll often kick their hairs off before they molt to kind of put a protective barrier. So if anything's trying to sniff away at them, it's going to get a nose full of hair. It's going to run off. So those hairs are in the enclosure. So like what I like a doofus, sometimes I do work on my dining room table and we have a fan above it. And I'm opening up the enclosures in the summertime and I'm going through it. Later on, I'm scratching my neck. I'm scratching my arms. Like, what happened? It's the hairs. And it does, the mild ones feel like fiberglass does. The more serious ones, you can get blisters. I've seen pictures of people that are literally bleeding from scratching because of the blisters. I got tagged by Lasiodora parahibana, the salmon bird eater. It's a very popular, large species, very popular in the hobby, very easy to take care of. But I'm extra sensitive to the hairs, apparently. And that's the other thing people don't realize. Something may be totally fine with me, but somebody else, it may tear them apart. And with that one, I got tagged on my two fingers and didn't realize that I'd scratched my eye. And I went to, and it was like my fingers were burning for a week and a half afterwards. I actually, like, it was starting to scar because I was scratching it so badly. I'd never had that bad of a reaction. And my eye was just blood red in the corner. And luckily, I've heard other stories where people have gotten hair in the eye and it's been really a terrible situation. It just burned and itched for quite some time. So there, it depends how, you know, some people are more sensitive than others. One thing I have read rather consistently and people need to be aware of is that the more you get exposed to them, the more sensitive you become. Usually you think you get exposed to something, you become more used to it. I've spoken to keepers that have been in the hobby since like the 80s that won't even keep new worlds anymore because just being in a room full of the new worlds was enough to trigger some really bad reactions.
Yeah, it's sort of similar to a lapid venom. People that work with cobras and whatnot, they develop that allergy. And have you ever taken a bite?
Never taken a bite. Okay. Never have and never plan to. And that's actually one of my big claims of fame, knock on wood. If I ever did tag, I would obviously let it out. But I really believe, and that's, again, back to those rehousing videos, I have a lot of people that will contact me and they'll start off with, I'm going to get this species. I know I'm going to get bit one point or another. And my response is always, no, don't go in with that attitude. Under most circumstances, there is no reason, if you're careful, you should ever get bit. I've worked with some very, you know, considered to be very defensive tarantulas. And I found that if you're careful, if you're relaxed, if you know when to abort, when something's going, you know, I've had people tell me I was rehousing, you know, a baboon species. Baboons are the tarantulas from Africa, really nasty bites. A lot of different species fall under that category, but they're known for being a little defensive. So rehousing my baboon species, they went nuts and started circling the enclosure. And I was trying to catch it with a cup. And I'm like, nope, right there. put the cap back on, put it on a quiet shelf, walk away. There's no point in even messing with it then. So that's one of the things I've tried to show people. And I'm glad because I have more people saying, I have no intention of getting bit. That's the way you should go into it because you don't need to get bit. There seems to be a myth out there that everybody that's been in the hobby has been bit. I just had somebody talk about the fact that I got bit by a baboon species and it didn't bother me. And I'm like, where did you get this from? I've never been bitten. So the trick is if you treat them with respect, 99.9% of the time, because they're so easy to take care of, you're opening a cage, you're dropping some food in, you're cleaning up, you know, some boluses, which is the remains of the prey. You pull those out, maybe clean a little poo off the side of the enclosure, but you watch where the spider is, you work carefully, you close it, you're fine. The only spot where you tend to be, you know, the spot where somebody's going to get bit is during those rehousings. And that's where, when you get into the discussion of beginner species versus advanced species, that's where a beginner species is going to be much more forgiving because if they get upset, they're going to kick hairs. If you're doing an old world species, they get upset, they're going to come at you, they're going to tag you. So that's where it's really important. I tell people, practice those rehousings, get it down to a science, figure out where you're comfortable with them, because 99% of the time you're going to be fine if you're being responsible. That's going to be the point where things could go south quickly. And depending on how you react, you could get tagged. But usually the ones that get bit, and even if you read bite reports, I used to go on when I first got into it, when I got into the old worlds, because that's a big transition for a lot of people, is moving from those, you know, the hairers to the ones that are going to bite. And I remember just reading every bite report I could get my hands on to see what started it, what led to the bite. And honest to God, it was like 90% of the time, it was somebody doing something silly, like trying to pose it for a picture or sticking their hand in to pull something out while it was in hunt mode, or it was something you could go, all right, you know what? I'm not going to do that. So I think that's important too, for people to read the bite reports and get kind of a feel for what's going to put you in that situation. Where are you going to be in danger, and what can you do to avoid being in that situation?
Yeah, develop a system that you can rely on. Exactly. And have an abort button. So let's jump into that. So I know on you have a bunch of care guides on, and if anyone's looking to get a tarantula or a spider, there's amazing care guides on your website, but you do have them differentiated between beginner, intermediate, advanced, and expert. And so I wanted to know how you make that differentiate. What puts a spider in each category?
It's a tricky one. And I've wrestled with this a lot because I'm working on a video of beginner species. And there's like the majority of people out there agree that beginner species lists are really good and useful. And a lot of the people I talk to, I mean, I talk to a lot of hobbyists and a lot of new hobbyists. That's a lot of my traffic to my videos, and especially my email is people, hi, I just watched your video. I want to get the species. I want information. There's also an argument that there's no such thing as a beginner species, and there's merit to it. I understand it, because I will tell you, I came from the snake hobby. I came from working with animals my entire life. I was the kid on the farm that would train down the wild things. I would train down, you know, tame things down, you know, chipmunks, stuff like that. I got really good at watching animals, watching their body language, watching their behavior. And that made a very easy transition for me to move from, you know, something as simple as goats and cats and dogs to snakes, knowing when they were going to strike, when they were in feeding mode, to eventually moving over to spiders, recognizing when they're relaxed, when they're tensing up, ready to move. So it was an easier transition for me. So I moved very quickly from getting the quote unquote beginner species into some of the quote unquote advanced species. I think my big thing is there's a couple things you need to consider. One is ease of care. Some of the species that are labeled as beginner species, it's not only about the temperament, but the fact they're very easy to care for. People getting into the hobby, there is a learning curve. I don't think it's as steep as some would like people to believe, but there is a learning curve when you start caring for them. You know, I can't tell you how many emails I get from people that set up a spider perfectly. They email me a week later, hey, I just want you to double check this and make sure this is okay, because it's a new animal and they're being conscientious, which is good. And eventually that will wear off, and that's when you start experimenting with the more difficult ones. So for example, a beginner species, you're not going to want to have to worry about moisture. And I'm not going to use humidity in this, because that's something I think that comes over from the reptile hobby, where you have to more carefully monitor, you know, specific humidity, or make sure that, you know, the humidity doesn't drop. With tarantulas, it's more, do they need moist substrate or do they need dry substrate? And as easy as that sounds, it causes more anxiety and more stress in the hobby because of years of care sheets telling people, you have to keep this at an ideal humidity of blank percent. Drives me absolutely insane, because if you do any research into where they come from, there's species that part of the year, absolutely, they're going to have humidity 90%. Another part of the year, dry winter, it's going to be lower. So nobody ever looks at that. They just look at that high and go, oh, it's a high humidity animal. So that's something I look at as far as beginners versus the intermediate or advanced is the care. Is it going to be something that's going to be easy to pick up? They're not going to have to worry about moisture so much. Water dish, hide, some substrate. I usually keep burrowing or fossorial species off of that list only because I found most beginners, it bores them to tears. They get a spider, and I remember being there, so I'm not judging, but you get a spider, you buy a tarantula, you want to show a tarantula to your friends. You don't want to show them a pile of dirt with a hole in it.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people like, there's a species, the cobalt blue, we'll just use its common name. It's sold in pet store. It's very readily available, a blue spider. Well, A, they're very nasty, and B, or can be very nasty, I should say, and B, if kept correctly, you never see them at all. And I can't tell you how many beginners go, is this a good starter species? And I go, no. A, you have to keep it moist. B, you're going to have to give it a lot of dirt to keep it happy. And if you keep it happy, you're never going to see it. If you don't keep it happy, you're going to have a spider that's going to scare the heck out of you. So that's something you have to look at is, and I think it gets overlooked, is the ease of care. And then as far as the old world species, I use rule of thumb. I think about your average 10 to 12 year old boy or girl who's getting their first pet. Parents look for something. I mean, obviously it doesn't happen all the time, but I've talked to a lot of younger kids whose parents have gone, yeah, we'll let you get a tarantula. They're easy to care for. You know, you can stick them in your room. You don't need extra heat, all the extra heat lamps and everything like that. I think about them and I think, all right, if that kid asked me, should I get an old world? I would say no. So I start there as kind of my baseline. I don't ever tell people they can't get old world tarantulas. And my guides, when I say intermediate, advanced, or beginner, whatever, that's a guideline. Some people jump right in, and that's where I think where I run into trouble is people going, who are you to tell me I can't get an old world tarantula? And I'm like, I'm not telling you can't get an old world tarantula. I would ask if you have any experience in keeping exotics. I would ask if you've done your research, but some people can jump right into it. But I do think with old worlds, I keep them off of beginner species because of the fact that, you know, people will go, I have old world tarantulas that are better behaved than my new worlds. And that's true. I do as well. Unfortunately, it's what happens if something goes wrong. With the new world, you're getting some uncomfortable hair. With an old world, you might be heading to the emergency room with excruciating pain that nothing's going to touch. So that's why I tend to take those out, but I'm not married to it. I've had people come up. I'm thinking of a keeper right now that, you know, 5 years ago, we were going back and forth. He's like, I want to get a P. murinus, which is the OBT, which is one of the most infamous. If you know tarantulas, it's this fiery orange spider that has a temperament, the match. And it's got this really bad reputation for being nasty. And he's like, I'm going to get three of these. And I went, all right, I normally wouldn't recommend it, but we talked. He seemed to be a smart enough guy. He'd done his research. He did fine with them. He did perfect. Who am I to tell him he can't have them? But that's not the average beginner. And that's what I have to think about when I put those lists together is somebody that has no experience in exotics, no experience in keeping tarantulas, maybe hasn't done a lot of research yet. We want to give them something that's going to be easy to care for so they don't get hurt. So hopefully the spider does well. And then something that's not going to get them into trouble if things go wrong.
That makes sense. And I know, like, obviously one of the biggest areas, like you said, where you're at risk is these when you're rehoming them. And that's a concept that's sort of foreign to me in terms of, is it because you have to start with a smaller enclosure and you really need to work your way up? Is that why rehoming is necessary, or can you start with something bigger?
That's an excellent question. I actually did one of my podcasts was on the dropping spiderlings into larger enclosures. The deal is, and this is where people, we get in these bizarre arguments about it. We try to pick, you know, we point to real world when it behooves us. So people will tell me, well, why can't I buy a half inch sling and drop it in a 20 gallon tank? Because in the real world, there's no tanks. Well, in the real world, they're not going to have perfect temperatures. They're not going to have somebody caring for them. They're not going to be living in a glass cage at all. They're not going to have water dishes. They're going to have predators. So it's one of those spots where you want to look at where they live. But I found that specifically with spiderlings, and I've raised a lot of them over the years, there's two issues with putting them in a large enclosure. Number one, you can't keep track of your spider. I can't tell you how many folks I've had that, and part of this problem will arise from people getting an old world and they'll go, I have an idea. I know I'm going to be in trouble when I have to rehouse it. So I'm going to buy this little tiny half inch sling and I'm going to drop it in the adult tank and then I'll never have to rehouse it. Right there, that's the wrong mindset. Right there, you're showing that you're scared of the spider. It's not a respect thing. You're terrified of doing that rehousing. And that's part of the process, being able to do those rehousings. That's a big part of the hobby, honestly. It's like with snakes, you took your snake out, you put it in a new cage, not a big deal. And you could start them in anything, really. It's a little different with them because those slings are so small, they can dry out, they can get lost. You have, like, people don't realize, I have people that will buy like a quarter inch sling online and then they'll email me, they screwed me over. This sling isn't anywhere near a quarter of an inch. Well, no, it's probably over a quarter of an inch. You're just not used to looking at how small they truly are. So if you drop that quarter inch sling into something like a gallon or 2 gallons or 3 gallons, you are not going to know if it's eating. You're not going to know if it's molting. You're going to see nothing but a pile of dirt. So I found that with the teeny tiny slings, they do benefit for being in those tighter enclosures. And I've had this argument where people have gone on and been, you know, said to me, you're inhumane. For them, that's their burrow. That if you put them in a little vial, that they'll dig down, they'll create a burrow, they'll web around it. They're comfortable in there. They're secure. You'll know because they're not going to bolt when you open the top. And then once they put on some size and develop that waxy coating that they have that allows them to not become dehydrated, because that's something a lot of people don't realize. It's the tiniest slings. They don't have that coating. There's a very real chance of them dehydrating if they don't get moisture. Once they get a little stronger, then you can put them into a larger enclosure. But it really, I did a whole thing on this because people, what would end up happening is somebody would contact me, and I never do I told you so, even though sometimes I think it, but somebody will contact me and go, you know what? I don't care what you say. They live that way in the wild. And then I get the, yeah, I think it's dead. I can't find it. I just dumped out all the dirt. It's gone. And you can't appreciate this until you see how small they really are. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, it totally makes sense now. I've even done things where I've taken a spider in, and a lot of times we use 16 ounce deli cups. They're kind of like the standard as far as a good size for a good size sling. But if you drop like a third of an inch spiderling in there, they can be smaller than the actual grains of substrate in there. That's how tiny they are. And wow, it can make it very difficult. Like you're looking in there, you've got a flashlight, you've got a magnifying glass, like where is this thing? And I've even had situations where I've dug stuff up because I'm like, this thing must have escaped. No, I find it. It's really upset because I just dug up its home. But it's important when you're raising slings, because they are more fragile, for you to be able to keep track of the slings at all times and monitor if they're eating. When they eat, when they're that small, a lot of times you have to give them pre-killed prey.
Mm. And what do you give them?
You can give them it. You can kill. There's one thing we call cricket drumsticks, where you rip off the leg of a cricket. Sounds gross. Or you just, sometimes they just discard them and you grab them. Mealworms are good. Mealworms can be refrigerated. You can cut them up into pieces. It sounds disgusting, but you drop a little segment of mealworm in there. You look for the next morning for it to be moved, because some of these slings are so small, they'll feed until they're completely full and it won't look like they ate anything. And that means, you know, and that when they're that tiny, you have to be able to monitor them. You have to be able to keep an eye on them. Once they get larger, you can put them in anything, as long as there's no, you know, fall damage is a possibility for a terrestrial. People don't realize that they're very fragile with those fat abdomens. They climb and fall. They can, you know, puncture themselves, bleed out and die. So it's important you give enough substrate, but you can put something in a huge aquarium, decorate it. That's one of the things I'm getting into now, is doing the larger ones with real plants, and they're fine. But for smaller specimens, it makes more sense to keep them something smaller so they can find the prey. That's another issue. And so that you can keep track of them.
Yeah, the humane thing in that case is actually just being able to keep track of it. Exactly. Without it, it's gone.
And I know how bad it looks, because I've been privy, and I actually get very little of this, which is great, because I've seen other people get torn apart where they come on and go, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself for keeping them in tiny little things. And I think I have seen situations where it's an adult tarantula and something that's ridiculously small, and that's not okay. That's not okay at all. They need to have some room. But what people don't realize is with tarantulas in the wild, it behooves them to stay out of sight. Many of them are nocturnal hunters. Many of them are ambush predators. They dig a burrow. They sit at that burrow. They don't leave the burrow. They basically wait for something to walk by. And if it comes by, they grab it and they eat it. That's their home. That's their safety. Usually it's only the males that go out venturing around. So when you set up an enclosure, I have one that I gave this really big enclosure to, and I gave her like a water, I gave her a hide and everything. I put her water dish on the opposite end, because that's just usually how you set it up. And I realized she wasn't going anywhere near to a water dish because she wasn't venturing out far. So I moved the water dish a little closer. So it's a tough line of thinking, because I think people's knee-jerk reaction, I remember being the same way, like, man, you should get them in a larger cage. It'd be better for the spider. What you're going to find is a spider that's going to find a corner. That's going to become its home. It's not going to do a lot of venturing out.
Yeah, especially if they're burrowed down, they have their home. That's kind of where they hang out. I really like the beginner guide that you had regarding the scientific names, and it definitely changed my, because I'm somebody that was, I'm not opposed to scientific names, but I just never use them. And I think they are more appealing to someone who's like a very excellent reader. And for me, when I see a word that I don't know, that I don't pronounce, I just memorize like the shape of the word and move on, you know? And there's a lot of people out there that are like that. It's just like, okay, that shape means this. I don't ever need to pronounce it. So scientific and Latin names are always like, wait, but I read through it. So maybe you could run through just kind of why they, especially in the spider hobby, why they are somewhat important.
There, yeah. And it's like, again, coming from the snake hobby, we never referred to them as their scientific names. That was a new thing to me. We don't refer to our dogs as our scientific specific names. We don't, you know, they have people sometimes compare it to breeds. It's not the same, it's different species. But the thing I learned early on with this, with the common names, and again, I'm not one of these people that yells at people when they use them. I've been privy to things on boards where people come up and go, my curly hair isn't, you know, I think it's in Primo. And somebody be like, what's a curly hair? Use a scientific name. That's ridiculous. Lay off. I mean, we know what we're talking about. They're talking about. The problem is they're not consistent from like the United States to overseas is a big issue. So if a lot of our stock in the United States is actually imported by European breeders, which a lot of people don't realize, we don't have enough breeding going on in the US to sustain the hobby. So we bring things over and their common names over there do not align with ours most of the time. They're not standardized. There's also an overlap in a lot of common names. So people will say, I have a giant white knee. I've heard of several tarantulas referred to as giant white knee. And that's the only time, like if somebody emails me with that, I ask clarifying questions. I've heard people call them the wrong scientific names before, which can make it confusing. So the scientific names, the good thing about them, and they do change sometimes because as we're studying more about the spiders, more research is being done, the taxonomies are being examined, sometimes they switch. But usually it's a very standard way of referring to them. They're terrible to learn. I remember going through, I forced myself to learn these early on because a lot of it's when you shop for them. When you shop for tarantulas, anybody that knows what they're doing that's selling tarantulas generally is going to put the scientific name first. If you go on, I try to warn people, if you go someplace like a show or a pet store and they say it's the golden red rump or whatever, be careful because it means they probably don't know what they have. And I get a lot of people emailing me with, I bought this, is this species? And they show me a picture. It's like, oh dear, you definitely have the wrong spider there. So the common names are good as far as like, they're obviously much, much easier to remember. It is a way to talk about them without having to learn those really difficult names that quite frankly, nobody can pronounce correctly because it's like Latin, Greek, everybody argues. I have one video where there's 12 different quote unquote experts in Latin arguing over how to pronounce the same word. And it's like, you're never going to get it right for everybody, but it's standardized. So when you get, the more deep you get into the hobby, when you're shopping for tarantulas, it makes it easier when you know the scientific names. When you're looking for care information, that's where it's really important because you want to make sure you don't get the wrong care information. We had somebody call one, the zebra knee tarantula over here is a Phaenopelma cimati, and it's got a different care than say a skeleton leg tarantula or something of that nature. And I had somebody come to me with something that was sold under the wrong name. And I thought I knew which species they were talking about. They didn't have a picture at the time, so I gave them care information. Well, come to find out, it was the wrong common name. And the information I gave them was completely wrong for that spider. And I had to quickly backtrack. Luckily, they got a photo. I'm like, whoa, whoa, back up. Sorry about that, wrong species. Where had it been the scientific name, there wouldn't have been an issue. I know that. I know those names. So it's tough, but I think for a lot of people in the hobby, it's like if you do martial arts and you get your black belt, well, a lot of them, when they start feeling like when they can throw those scientific names around, that's like kind of a pride thing. Like it's almost like learning a second language. Like I'm not going my curly hair. I got my Phaenopelma albopilosum over here. And it's kind of a neat, I know when I started throwing them around and Billy's had to listen to me talk about them for years. And she's actually, the proud moments for me is when she's actually throwing around the scientific names now. So it's tough. They are difficult to read. I will tell you right now, you're going to get a million different pronunciations for them. But the majority of the time you use them, you are reading them or at least recognizing, like even if you can't pronounce Pisolitheria or Posolitheria, whichever way you pronounce it, you'll recognize that name, know which spider you're looking for.
Yeah, and you have a great link on the website just with some phonetics, like phonetic spelling or to be able to pronounce some of those things. And that definitely helps. And we have the classification for a reason. So it is obviously useful.
Yeah, it's very useful. And I think that's where people, when you get deeper into the hobby, you recognize we have a problem with the hobby where we have things called hobby forms. And what happens is somebody will go out, and this is the sad part about the hobby, somebody will discover a new spider. And unfortunately, a bunch of people will come down, grab a bunch of them out of the wild, start breeding them and try to get them into the hobby, which part of me is like, at least they'll be there because a lot of these places, they're not protected. They're losing their territory. They're not going to be around in 100 years. So it's like, at least they'll be around in the hobby. But then part of me recognizes the fact that we're contributing to the issue. But what ends up happening is they'll come, they'll grab a species from someplace. They'll have no idea what it is. So they'll make up some name for it. And it'll get into the hobby and nobody knows what they got. And this is where we end up with things called hobby forms, which means we're not even sure this thing's been sold in the hobby as we have one species, Canthoscuria brocklehursti, it's called. It sounds very complicated. But we've actually found out that the thing we've been calling Brocklehursti for years is not a Brocklehursti. It's another species entirely. And the real Brocklehursti has never been in the hobby. So that's where you start getting some of the messiness, where it makes sense to do a little studying, know the origins of the name, recognize the ones that have been legitimately identified, and recognize the ones that there might be a problem with, and keep them kind of to the side until somebody can study them and we know what they are.
Yeah. You have some hobbyists that just, you know, name something, or they look at a Google image and say, hey, that kind of looks like this, probably what this is. And
And then we have people that make up the common names. That's the flip side. Right. I did a joke years ago. Which spider was, I think it was the spider's called the Lasiodora itabune. And there's also a huge problem with a lot of spiders. There's no common names. So when people try to rely on common names, you'll find a situation where I've had people go on my videos, could you please tell me the common name? There is none. So I got a little cheeky one day and I called it the fire hiney. And it was a joke. I figured everybody would giggle. I labeled it as the fire hiney. I've had more people email me legitimately like, hey, I got a fire hiney. And I'm like, oh no, that was totally
what did you
like,
do?
Yeah, it was like, and it seemed funny at the time, but I forget that people are looking at to me to give them accurate information. And I forget sometimes that my sense of humor when it squeaks in probably isn't the right place. So we've had a couple of those over the years where people go, yeah, I picked up a fire hiney. I'm so excited. And I just kind of run with it. Like, all right, whatever.
Yeah, that's the care still works.
Still works. It's the same stuff, yeah.
So in terms of future plans, and you have kind of a lot going on. You got the blog, and you're doing some videos. And I think, are you doing some breeding as well?
I am doing some breeding. It's something I have to pick my spots with, because breeding is, I think, for a lot of people that really get into the hobby, that's the final step. When you start producing them yourself, it's huge. And I've done it a couple times, and it's really been it's amazing, because you raise them and now it's like, I've gone the whole nine. I bred my own females that I raised up from babies, got the babies, keep the babies. And now I have adults from some of those babies. It's awesome, but it's hugely time intensive. It's a lot of work. And when you already, you know, have over 100 tarantulas, some of these things, I tell the story where the first species I decided to breed, I had read a bunch of breeding reports and they said you could expect anywhere from around 30 to maybe 90 babies. We bred this girl. We ended up with 400 babies.
Oh my God.
I don't mind telling you, 400 babies, a lot different than 90 or 35. It was, you know, I'm not going to lie, there was like a nightmare moment where it's like, what have I done? Like, we have, and they're tiny little guys. We're trying to separate them out. I had bought, you know, 100 little cups to put them in. Well, then we're scrambling to buy more cups. It was a huge learning experience. And it, right then and there is when I'm like, all right, I need to be a lot more strategic to when I breed and what I breed, because I have one that I really wanted to breed, found out that you're looking at 2,000 babies.
Oh my God.
I don't have the time in the day. Like, I have a very strict schedule where I feed mine. I make sure, you know, they're getting taken care of a lot. And it's time intensive. That's just too much to deal with. So I pick my spots now. One of my favorite species, Ophilopinus, it's obviously a Philippine species, Philippine tangerine, beautiful spider. One of the first old worlds I got. It's a female that I picked up as a sling. She's got a sac right now that should be ready within the next 3 or 4 days. Really excited about that, because when I first started Tom's Big Spiders, I love the color orange. And so I picked an orange spider for kind of my logo. And that one was my logo for many years. So it's really cool to be able to reproduce that one. I also bred a Brazilian species. It's Brazilian Redhead is the common name, Bumba Cabocla, which I think is one of the coolest scientific names ever. It just sounds cool. And bred her. Interesting situation where the males, they're notoriously, the females will eat the males sometimes. In nature, it's like the female's way of getting that nutrients they need to really start that egg sac off well. And a lot of the males are smaller than the female, so it's almost like they're lunch size. So they do their deed, and then the female just folds them over, munches them, and she's got her first meal. And this species, they're notorious for eating the males. So the first time I introduced the male in, when you breed one of these species where the males often get eaten, the males seem to be programmed to recognize that they're in trouble. So they're acting extra careful. So the first time the dude just ran away from her. It was like, no, he was like, I'm not having, she's drumming up. And I'm like, here we go. And the male took off. Second time I go to try to get the male over, he bolts and ends up laying on top of her crossways. And I'm like, this is not going to go well. And he ended up flipping her over. It was a weird breeding mating ritual they did. I have it on video. It was like, I don't even know if I can post this, but she took, it was great. She laid it. She webbed up her whole enclosure about 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, laid her sack. I came back the next day. She'd ate the whole thing, and really disappointed with that one, because this is a species that we're no longer able to import, because the Brazilian species, there's a ban on importing them in from other countries now, which is unfortunate because we have some beautiful ones. And so it's really important that we start breeding them over here. and no sack, completely gone. So I will be trying to breed her again. The male's probably not going to be too keen on it because he survived the last one, but I sit there with paintbrushes ready to break them up and hopefully we'll get something.
Yeah. It's definitely a really good point, and that's the advancing into the breeding side to both the reptile and obviously the invert hobby. It's like the next level and everybody wants to do it, but you do have to be very careful that you're not doing it and you're going to deal with a bunch of offspring that you have no place for, or can't, the market can't handle.
And that's thank you for bringing it up. That's another huge point. Is there a species, like any species, that breeds easily that produces 2000 slings? They're a dime a dozen. So what I did a whole podcast, one of my podcasts was on, if you're interested in breeding, here are some things you need to ask yourself first. And one of them is, are people going to buy these? Like, just because you can breed it, that's great. But now you have to do something with them. And a lot of people have this image that, oh, I'm going to sell them all separately myself. I'm going to take, 400 slings and put them up for, on some site and sell them. They don't realize how much it costs to ship. They don't realize how much it costs for the packing materials, for heating. If you send them, there's a lot of costs. And plus it's time intensive. So it's something people really need to do a little research on and pick the species they're going to begin with carefully. Look for something that's going to breed easy, that's not particularly expensive right off the bat, and that people are constantly buying so that you're going to have a market. Worst case scenario, you contact a wholesaler, somebody that does wholesaling, and you wholesale them to them, sell them to them. You get a little money or trade them up. I do a lot of trading with mine. I'm not into making a lot of money off these. It's not a money-making endeavor, but I like trading. So it's like, all right, you know what? You take this whole batch of slings. This is going to save me a lot of time and give me a couple things and we'll call it even.
Yeah. That's definitely the more ethical way to go. It's got to be more of a passion than just trying to make money off it, because agreed, it's actually difficult to make money off of
them. Yes, it is. And I think a lot of people, I can't tell you how many times I hate this, and it's probably my biggest pet peeve, is when people contact me, hey, Tom, great, thanks for all the videos, love it. I'm just getting into a hobby. I love your videos. Here's my plan. I'm going to buy a bunch of females and I'm going to get a bunch of males and I'm going to breed them. And I'm thinking within 5 years or so, it's like, dude, you haven't even kept them yet. Like, learn how to take care of them first. And I know one that hit me up, and he basically, this was his whole plan, and he started selling, and the guy crashed and burned so quickly. It was sorry to watch, but I tried to warn him. I'm like, listen, spend some time with him first, but he was out that he was going to get rich off it. And it's not a get rich thing. You have, even the people that sell them, the people that are doing the big business and selling these, it began for a love of them. You have to, this is a lot of work, and it's a weird business. It can be a tough business. So you have to really love what you're doing. So if you don't love the animals, if you're not really into them, you're not doing the research, don't bother doing any of the breeding stuff. You're not really doing anybody any favors. And what you're going to end up with is a bunch of slings you can't move, and God only knows what happens to them. I've heard horror stories of people putting egg sacs in freezers because they're like, well, I can't do anything with this. And that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I always tell people too, it's like, you need to be able to run a business as well. So
agreed.
And it's not a simple business when the product you're producing eats and you have to, they're a live creature. So if you don't know how to run business, you shouldn't jump into a business that has live animals.
Live, exactly. And like I told the story, my wife and I used to do like publishing small press books and stuff. And like the shipping, people don't understand how difficult it is to pack up spiders for shipping.
I bet.
And we do books, and that was tough enough. You get in, you're shipping out 100 books. You're sitting there at the dinner table. You could leave them in boxes. And like, I don't feel like going to FedEx tomorrow. I don't feel like going to the post office. They can sit there. You can't do that with animals. You have to, Sunday night, you're shipping Monday morning. Sunday night, you're up late putting those heat packs in. They're only going to last so long. And you got to take those things, get them packed and get them out. And a lot of people don't think of the logistics of that how, ridiculously difficult that can be. And then they find themselves in a spot like, wow, this is terrible. This isn't what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Tom, thank you very much for this conversation. This hour has flown by. We're already over time here. So,
sorry about that.
Oh, no. I have all day, but I always want to make sure that I'm not eating up my guests' time. So this is a fantastic chat. Can you let everybody know where they can find you, the various places online that you live?
Absolutely. Well, they can find me on my podcast is Tom's Big Spiders. If you look it up, I can't remember the exact address, but you can find it. That's been the newer endeavor for me. And it's been a lot of fun because I can get more conversational when the videos I have to. It's more of a visual medium, so I have to make sure that there's a lot of cool things going on. Then I have tomsbigspiders.com, which is the original blog where I have all the husbandry information for people that like to read and don't mind reading. That's the place to start because the articles, go ahead, print them out. I've had people tell me, is it okay if I print them out? Absolutely. The information is out there for people to use. I'm not doing it to, get rich or famous. I want to help people out, and I love hearing when it does help people out. And then Tom's Big Spiders on YouTube is my YouTube channel, which is doing quite well. It's not going to be, you know, if you're looking for the entertainment train wrecks, that's not what you're going to find, but I try to keep it very educational. Again, my forte is those rehousing videos and then species specific husbandry videos where I talk about ones that I've raised from slings all the way up and try to give as much information as you'll need. I do have a lot of the tutorials that are on the website up on YouTube as well. So there's video versions, like for example, my sling guide, there's a video version of that that does really well. Beginner species lists, things of that nature for people that are, you know, if you're looking for accurate information, definitely start with me, but do your research, go out there, check everybody out.
Yeah. And as someone who's not in the tarantula hobby at all, I found a lot of enjoyment out of, you know, going through your videos, and I'm going to continue to do that. I don't know if I'm getting a tarantula anytime soon. My fiance probably, hopefully she doesn't hear that, but it's been really, like the videos are super fun to watch. So even if you don't plan on getting one, like definitely go check out the videos, because it's, they're amazing species. So thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So again, thank you to Dylan for not only agreeing to do or asking me to be on the show, but for allowing me to run it on my channel. I thought that was incredibly classy of him, and hopefully we'll be able to return the favor in the future. But that was a lot of fun and stuff that I haven't really gotten to talk about before. Hopefully I didn't ramble too much, because it gets tough. The whole live thing was really killing me. We had Billy sitting out here trying to keep all the dogs from acting up, and it was like I didn't want to screw up his whole podcast by having dogs barking or clicking in the background. That's kind of my thing. But he was awesome with it. It was great to work with, and hopefully we'll be able to touch base with him again in the future. So again, if you guys want, if you enjoyed that, you know, definitely encourage you to check out more of his stuff, because it really is a worthwhile listen. So anyway, that will do it for this incredibly long podcast. I should have saved this for like the 100th episode or something. Could have cheated and just used that to buff it up, make it look like it was extra special. But anyway, you got 30 minutes of new material. And for those of you that haven't heard this interview before, over an hour and a half of material, it looks like. And for those of you that have listened to it, at least you got, they used to be a half hour long. So you got 30 minutes of new material. How's that? So anyway, thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you guys all next time.